So you're listening to WOOL Radio 91.5 FM from Bellows Falls, Vermont. We've gathered a group of friends here to talk about different wines. It's an experiment that we're making for a show that could become a series called What's My Wine? This evening, we thought our first experiment would be looking at the Cahors wine. It's a Malbec grape. And this came about because a friend was recently visiting from France and began to wax poetic around an amazing dish, a traditional French dish in the countryside called cassoulet. And the wine that goes with cassoulet is the beautiful, deep, complex Cahors wine. And that is what made us think, well, why don't we try for our first show to look at the Cahors wine? And it's a great topic because none of us have any experience with this wine, like virtually at all. We've got, I think, five or six wines that we're ready to taste. And I'm going to introduce briefly the people who you will be hearing talking about the wine. We have Joe Canini, who ran a wonderful inn in Vermont, the Windham Hill Inn. We have Larry Burdick, who is a wonderful chef and, of course, entrepreneur with the amazing chocolate shop that is now a phenomenon in the chocolate world. And Keith Zimmerman, who is someone who has made wines at the Biltmore Estate. He has a tremendous experience in making wines. So among the four of us, we're going to have a little exploration of Cahors wines. And I'd like to, first of all, start off by looking at, okay, so what is this cassoulet, this dish, that made it so important for us to understand the Cahors wines that married so beautifully with this dish? Larry, have you made cassoulet?
Yes, I have. I mean, it's been very many years since I made one, but it had the usual white beans, of course. It had a lamb stock and pieces of lamb and duck in it. There's a little tomato in it. There's herbs from that area. It's a delicious, hearty dish. Often, so there's a little saucisson de Toulouse usually in, which is a very garlicky, delicious sausage.
Well, when we got on the trail of this because of this friend, what was his name, Nicholas?
Julien.
Oh, Julien, yes, yeah. He was so enamored with this dish, his grandmother would make it, right, in Cahors. So we sourced these white beans, these cannellini beans that were grown right here in Vermont, actually, and local, organic, and we got the pork belly, the lamb, and the pork tenderized by roasting it in the oven. Keith, I think you contributed the duck confit. It just went on and on. There were so many ingredients and so deep and earthy, like the whole dish was so earthy. So maybe that brings us to thinking about what kind of wine naturally goes with such an amazing dish.
The exact ingredients changes from person to person, really.
Yeah.
But the spirit of the dish seems to be always the same. Probably the white beans is the most consistent.
Well, yes, and 15 different kinds of meats.
And garlic.
Garlic and the pork belly and the pancetta or something. I mean, there's those deepening flavors in the bottom of the bowl. It's pretty extraordinary.
We're talking about a wine that needs to be substantive, because
yes,
otherwise it can't stand up.
It has to have
a
muscle
like that.
Right, 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 exactly.
Real power.
So, Joe, tell us what you've learned about Malbec as you've gotten ready to step up to this table here.
Well, I learned in this area of France, Malbec is actually called different things. It's called Côte, it's called Auxerrois. It's a grape that's used throughout much of France. Certainly it's used in Bordeaux as one of the five or seven varietals that go into a Bordeaux blend. And it was often used to impart color and body. So known as the black wine since medieval times, Malbec or Côte, as it was known then, has become important in the history of French winemaking. It was very sought after. In fact, was shipped back to the Russian royal court via England. And I want to talk about shipping at some point because I think it's a really important.
Yeah, I was fascinated by this.
It was often a wine used for ceremonial purposes in the Orthodox Church. Again, it's that the black wine. It was very distinctive.
You know, in that region of Cahors, it was originally settled by the Celts. And then when it was overcome by the Romans, and there were these trade routes that were established between there through Bordeaux and back to England. And then from there, it was transported to Russia, and it became like the wine to have, that black wine in Russia. And maybe it's because of that affiliation with the Russian Orthodox Church. I don't know.
Yeah, and they copied it. The Moldovan wine industry is very much based on a varietal that mimics Malbec. So Georgian wine is incredibly rich and has tons of fruit in it. So it's gone further around the globe, this grape, than you would imagine.
It's interesting to note that this was traveling throughout Europe and into Russia in the 12th and 13th centuries. Like, that's the part that just blew my mind, that this grape has been so foundational to the trade among these different territories all throughout Europe and Eastern Europe. Let's talk about the attributes of this wine, this black wine from centuries back. It has a very, very deep and earthy undertone to the whole taste profile.
When we decided to do this show with the Cahors, it's not an easy wine to find. This one happened to come from Brattleboro, and it's called De Combel La Serre Cahors La Pure Fruit. It's a 2022 vintage. This is the second wine of this particular house, so it's not the reserve wine. And it's, my guess is it's made for earlier consumption, not a wine that needs to age for a long, long time.
But let me ask you about that, because it does say that some of the Cahors wines, they could be aged like from now until 2030, for example, right? So now we're going to open up a bottle that's 2022, so maybe a little young. But is this a particular vintage that has been designed to be opened as a younger wine? Is that...
Honestly, I don't know enough about these wines, so I can't say for sure. It's just a hunch that this producer, because they have a wine that is likely you'd sell her for quite a while, and that this is their second wine, and I'm guessing that it's probably produced to consume sooner, to generate some income for the winery. I was to go back in the history of Cahors a little bit, because Cahors... what used to be 80,000 hectares. That was the largest wine growing area in France in the Middle Ages. I think it peaked at the 80,000 in 1880-ish, is when that much land was under vine cultivated. And towards the end of that 19th century, there was the phylloxera attacked the vines in France, and it literally wiped out all the Malbec in the Cahors area. The Malbec moved to, some cuttings went to Argentina. That's one of the reasons why you see so much Malbec from Argentina and why there's so little in the Cahors. They had a long time trying to revive their viticulture there. It got an AOC designation, I think, in...
82, I want to say, but maybe even later.
I've got 71.
Okay.
So yeah. 1971, it received an AOC designation.
And that really coincided with the area making a decent comeback from both... two things. It was phylloxera in the late 1800s, and then an incredibly severe frost in 1956, which is, you know, sort of in the annals of French winemaking, where so many of the crops were totally wiped out, and so it was a replanting exercise once again. But I find it interesting that this area is so incredibly protective of what it had historically. They have resisted all commercial pushes to move into Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon. There are historical reasons, I think, for that, too. There was this long-running hegemony of Bordeaux as a city. I always tell people who are interested in wine, if you really want to know where good wine regions might be, just follow the rivers, right? Follow the rivers in any given country, and if you get the right soil and you have rivers, you're likely to find vineyards. Their vineyards are upstream of the ocean, and Bordeaux being on the ocean. But the Lot and Garonne rivers, Lot River in the case of Cahors, flowed into Bordeaux. And there was actually different kingdoms at one point in France that complicated matters. But in this case, in Cahors' case, their wines were prevented from using Bordeaux as an exit port until all the serious reds from Bordeaux had been sold for the year.
See, it pays to be a gate city to the ocean. You can control all trade.
Totally. And Bordeaux did control all that trade. So these people in Cahors were either late, or if they wanted to get their wine somewhere early, it was across the Pyrenees. There weren't a lot of options. That's one of the reasons I think they've become so fiercely protective of what it is they have.
Well, also they have a wine that has a unique characteristic to it as well. And one thing that I was struck by, it was through this initiative, the pre-phylloxera, where there were cuttings that were sent out and broadcast throughout the world, Argentina, South Africa, Australia, California. And it was after that devastating blight that France was able to sort of call back some of those original plantings and revitalize the entire winemaking industry, which was an extraordinary undertaking.
Most vinifera grapes are grafted to an American rootstock, which is resistant to the phylloxera.
It's remarkable, actually.
Yeah, pest. It's a pest.
Yes, so. This pas de deux between, you know, the various countries, in order to revitalize the entire winemaking industry. But then when you think about the change that happened with the Malbec, it does seem as though there was a shift in the approach to how this grape was going to be used, the Malbec grape. The wines became less sharp-edged, less tannic, a little bit not soft, but maybe a little bit rounder. We have two wines that we're tasting at the moment, De Combelles-la-Serre, Cahors, which is a 2022. And then we opened another bottle. It's a Cahors from the Odile Delpont, and that is a 2020. So, Larry, what are you tasting?
I'm surprised that the alcohol content is so reasonable. I don't know the wines very well, but usually a wine from the south part of France would probably, these days especially, have pretty high alcohol content. What do you think, Joe Keith? The reason for that would be, is that a stylistic choice being made by winemakers? Is there a climate thing going on there, a microclimate?
I bet they could get it riper if they wanted. I just think it's proximity to Bordeaux. It's not that far away. And the sort of the accepted 13 and 13 and a half Bordeaux marker is observed by winemakers there.
But that first one is 12 and a half. That surprised me.
Yeah.
I know, and it's lovely. It's lovely.
Lovely. It's got a really great flavor, yeah.
But I'm also hoping that it's going to open up a little bit more in the glass, that it has, you know, just a little bit around the edges. You know, it feels like it needs to soften.
The tannins are pretty firm. Yeah, they're firm.
I looked in my Larousse of wines and looked up Cahors. It's a book from the early 70s. In there, they were saying Cahors wines spend 3, 4, 5 years in a cask and then be bottled afterwards and then spend another 3 or 4 years before being drunk. That's what was being recommended by some people back in those days. But these are very young.
They do taste young, but they're lively without being like overly fruit forward. I mean, if that's one way to describe it.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, in one of the sites where I was doing research, it says the top priority for the Malbec is usually tannin management. Now, Keith, what is tannin management?
Well, the tannin is sort of like if you were chewing on a piece of wood. You know, it's the tannin is in the skin or the stems. That's why they de-stem a lot of red grapes and they don't ferment with the stems. It would be, how do you not let that get out of control? So maybe you don't use new wine barrels. You know, you use used wine barrels or a larger foudre or a larger tank. Or maybe you ferment in cement or you ferment in stainless steel. And you just stay away from adding any more woody character to the wines at all. Also, Larry was getting at these long aging process. The tannins over time will soften. That's why you would age these wines for a long time.
Well, you know, they also said that the bunches of grapes are often destemmed, although they will keep some bunches of grape on the stem, and maybe it's to calibrate that amount of tannin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the winemaker's art.
Right.
That's really the winemaker's art.
It's the alchemy.
It's the alchemy.
No kidding.
What do they want to do? And you know, do they crush the grapes and let them macerate with the skins for however long? When do they add the yeast? Do they add the yeast immediately and get the fermentation started?
Then you usually have, even if they do it in these cement, like sort of in more inert containers for their initial fermentations, you end up with lots of juice with lots of skins and maybe not stems, but maybe on top. And they call that a cap. There's all kinds of management techniques for the relationship between that juice and that cap. And sometimes they punch down the cap. Sometimes they pump wine from the bottom and let it go over it again. And that all comes into tannin management and flavor extraction, color, etc. So
when you say inert, you're talking about a cask like steel?
Steel Either
tanks
steel or
as
cement.
Opposed to
cement,
the
cement
oak?
And,
the
I think
French
cement
oak.
And steel would be the two, two basic.
There was another term that I came across, pigeage, which is the punch down. Is that what you were just describing, Joe?
Yeah.
It's a great word, pigeage. part of this new approach to the aging of this wine. They're aging in concrete and amphora, and the winemakers are arguing that the amphora actually encourages a more pure expression of the Malbec. In this write-up, it says, with elegant tannins. And so the result is the Malbecs being made today are the best expression of the Malbecs, hands down. Like, in other words, there's been this arc.
In the cohort,
arc.
You mean?
Yes, in the cohort, yeah.
I think Argentinians might take a little, stylistically, just a little bit different. Maybe growing conditions, I'm not sure, but I find them to be generally softer wines. I find the cohort to be slightly more robust. One thing that this has that I don't think you'd find in an Argentinian Malbec is this has the Southern French garrigue, you know, that people talk about all the time. It's just around the edges of this wine you get that.
Yeah.
Because these vines will go right up to wherever the mountain starts, and usually that's pine forest, that's got rosemary growing thyme growing wild.
Yeah.
And so that is what they call that garrigue, that transitioning place between the vines and then the forest.
Hmm. Lovely.
Lots of sense.
Lovely description.
Yeah, lots of sense. And I find that in this wine. And
I find it particularly in the second.
I haven't tasted the second one yet.
This second one is immediately accessible. It's some like raspberry and violet going on.
Nice, yeah.
And less tannic than the first, which is changing even now as it sits in the glass.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the second one is nice. That second wine is, it gives us an opportunity to talk about négociant wines, which is a way of showcasing smaller properties that would never produce enough on their own to become a major seller, exporter.
Is that what the second wine is?
Yeah, it's a négociant wine, and the négociant is a young woman named Mary Taylor. She's worked in vineyards all over France and South America as well. She looks like she's a young woman, but she has an amazing stable of small, hard-to-find, underrepresented wines in the world that she's put together under one umbrella. And that's what négociants do. They support by buying the production of small producers, those producers, and they might help them package and get import license or export licenses for them, et cetera.
Now, so, do you mean like a Louis Jadot in
Louis
Burgundy and
Louis
maybe
Jadot
on a
would
bigger
be a great,
scale?
Yeah. Louis Jadot and in Beaujolais, it would be Georges Fleury or Georges Zabouf, I'm sorry. Those are négociants. This Mary Taylor wine, I kind of like it too.
It's sort of immediately accessible.
Yeah.
But this one, in the first one's coming around in the glass.
So we've just poured a third wine, and before we talk about it, I just wanted to mention again that you're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM radio.
You know, before we go on, Cynthia, I just want to come back to that concept of the second versus the first wine. We're all finding it's a little brighter, it's fruit forward, etc.
The second wine, which is the 2020
fermented and aged in stainless steel, does not see any wood whatsoever.
That's
an interesting fun fact,
because
oftentimes,
because you can taste it,
well, it's just pure, you know, the purity of fruit, not muddied up by any wood.
Well, at the same time, that first wine is definitely, it's gaining character. It's losing a little bit of that astringent edge to it. So the wine that we've just poured is, Larry, can you see the label?
Chateau Les Eaux d'Aglon, 2019.
So a little bit more age on it.
It's a core. I had that sent in from Brooklyn. This one has the European biological symbol on the label.
That's a lovely bottle of wine. It has an approachability. It's really round to me.
Well, they have such a good writer at this distributor, and they were talking about aromas of dried plums, brandied cherries, and fresh forest mushrooms. It's a very, very lofty series of adjectives, but you know what? Maybe it will prove out.
I thought he was exaggerating and using hyperbole, but maybe not, now that I'm tasting it.
Well, especially as it comes up to temperature. So we have three wines in front of us, different characteristics, based not only on the age, but also on, of course, the vintner, but this foundational similarity that's running through, which is the characteristics of this grape. I do feel as though the Malbec is so right for pairing food that has a lot of soul and a lot of deep flavors to it.
Winter food.
Yeah,
definitely.
Winter food. And you can almost feel that just from the region that it comes from, the Cahors, which is sort of in the center of France, north of Toulouse, just to the east of Bordeaux. there's a earthiness there. There's, you know, when they talk about terroir relative to wines, there is this intrinsic connection between the geology of the land, the quality of the land, the culture of the land, and the expression of the land through the grape. And I feel like this is something we're tasting.
And to me, these three wines are very different.
Yeah.
The first one to this last one we're trying. To me, this last one, it's still very tight. It's not opened up and fragrant.
I'm glad you said
to me,
that.
To me, it could use more time in the bottle, even though it's older than the other two, to my taste.
And the distributor says, drink it now or through 2030. So it was really meant to be in the bottle now for a little bit longer.
The tannin is still quite strong in that wine, which is not a surprise. I mean, this is Malbec. The other two grapes that are allowed in the Cahora area are Tannat and Merlot. So those are the three grapes that are allowed in that AOC area.
But nonetheless, there has to be at least 70% of Malbec.
Of Malbec.
In the wine.
Yeah. But those grapes used to soften, I think, more than anything else, don't you think?
Right, but Tannat's also very astringent.
Very astringent, yeah.
Great. So the Merlot would be the one that's probably carrying the water.
Merlot's the softener.
It's probably the softener.
The Tannat is not at all.
Not a softener.
So these are wines that Cynthia and Joe and Larry and I have not had, and it's an area of France that we're not that familiar with. I've had Cahors over the years, but very few.
It's kind of an area that gets overlooked, and I think that's one of the fun things of doing these programs. We can explore as well as showing the way for hopefully a lot of other people who want to just learn a little bit about wine. It's a fun exploration. I'm really excited that although it is a region where the wines are harder to find, we're able to put together five or six fairly short order to go with grapefruit.
It was a bit of a search. I mean, you know, we found some wines in New Hampshire. We found some wines in Vermont. Mm-hmm. You found a wine down in Massachusetts, and Larry found a wine in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
So, you know, they weren't
easy to source.
Easy to source, but the search was fun.
Now, did you bring the Eulalie?
I did.
So this is a 2012. So it's going to be 10 years older than the first wine. So I just poured a little bit in your glass if you want to give that a taste. So that would bring us to four very, very different Malbecs.
Oh, I just wanted to mention, Keith and Joe just pointed out, we found four or five of these in the area. If you're outside that region of France, even around France, I haven't seen a lot of Cahors. I mean, you really got to look for them.
When you travel and you find yourself in these sort of pockets of France or Italy, and there are wines that are made there regionally that are for the people that live there and work there and cook their own food.
The Cassoulet.
Oh, and that's something else that we were going to mention, the cheeses that might go with this. There, so we have some sharp cheeses like a sheep's milk cheese from northern Spain. They also mentioned that maybe a blue cheese would be interesting to go with this wine because the depth and the edge of this wine is so pronounced.
I think Roquefort is from this area.
It could be, yes, Roquefort.
Roquefort is from this area, yeah. Just find the foods that they make there, and typically speaking, those are the foods that go with the wine almost anywhere in the world.
Right. But it's a good profile of very hearty country cheese, something that has a little bit of a bite to it, you know, a little bit of an edge to it.
Yeah.
And there it is. It's the perfect marriage with the type of wine as well. So when we made the cassoulet, we layered the bottom with a port belly, and then we put in layers of the cooked beans. We put in layers of sausage, lamb sausage with garlic, then layer of beans, the duck confit. It just was layering protein and beans with plenty of garlic.
And beautiful stock.
And then that beautiful, beautiful mushroom stock. It was an elegant dish. Larry, as you had mentioned earlier, everyone does their own version of cassoulet depending on what's from the garden and what's in the refrigerator. But this was a mighty, mighty dish, and the Malbec was perfection.
Larry, do you think when people commit to making a cassoulet, because it's a commitment, it takes some time, is it more of a special occasion?
It's considered a peasant dish, Joe, as you said. But in the old days, people had more time, and people lived on farms, and people had access to all those ingredients easily. You mentioned the stock. The stock is so important. The other ingredients, I mean, not everybody has access to lamb or duck or sausages.
Yeah, actually, Julien, the young Frenchman who was visiting here, said that his grandmother and grandparents who were from south of the city of Cahors, actually closer to the town of Albi. It's just a tiny little village, Larry. I looked it on MapQuest, and it looked like there were maybe 10 buildings in the little village. I mean, a speck. And Julien said his grandmother, when we made the cassoulet here, he's with the duck and everything. And Julien says, my grandmother never had duck. We were poor farmers.
We had what
they raised.
And of course, this is a dish where you use some of the parts of the animal that maybe require long and slow cooking.
And
then you get that really deep, beautiful flavor out of the dish. We've poured the fourth wine. It's the Eulalie 2012. Worth noting that it's 12.5% alcohol. So again, it's very, very light. There's this beautiful light quality to it in terms of the alcohol, but the flavor and the berry quality, I think, is lovely and pronounced.
Is anybody else getting this like herbal thing in it? Like almost like eucalyptus type herb.
Yeah,
that's that's a bad thing.
No,
either,
it's like right?
No, it's a top note. It's a minty, mm-hmm. Sort of
yeah,
thing.
Minty, mm-hmm. Yeah, minty,
yeah.
Really nice.
Like often you find in a Bordeaux.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. I often find that eucalyptic minty taste.
Yeah, or Napa Cabernet.
We'll have that as well.
Now, see, that's interesting because minty is not necessarily an adjective that one would ascribe to wine.
Well, no, the eucalyptus was the better descriptor than mint.
But, you know, it's also a contrivance for that very, very rounded taste profile to the wine, and that gives it the top.
The vocabulary of tasting is always approximative.
Yes.
And different people find different ways of expressing it.
To me, if I'm trying wines, I like to buy a couple of bottles, or maybe I try one just to see if it's any good at all, and then I'll go back and I'll buy two or three just to be able to try them over time with different foods.
Boy, that's so smart.
Because sometimes it's different with the food you're having or the company you're enjoying the wine with.
Well, and also we change. The way that we're tasting things changes as well. You know, our mood changes. And it's very interesting because you can have the same wine from one day to the next and have a very different experience. You know, one thing when you were talking earlier, Keith, about the size of Cahors, I mean, this is a very, very small region. And what I had found was that there's, I think, 7,500 acres total that are under cultivation right now for the Malbec grape, which is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it is a very, very small parcel of land that is responsible for carrying forward this entire legacy of Malbec winemaking in France. But what I've discovered in some of this travel that I've done in France and different parts of Europe, it is so surprising how small the regions are for the amazing reputations they carry, for the quality of wine that they produce. And when you get there, you think, oh my goodness, is this Chateau Neuf du Pape? You know, I mean, it's just a crossroads, right? Margaux is a crossroads in the middle of vineyards that extend in every direction. And it's just by way of saying, the things that we find so exceptional in this world are often things that are done in small production levels, artisanally, by hand, with careful oversight. And the wines, I think, are just such a beautiful expression of that. And even though they have such grand reputations, really every bottle that you open is a bottle that has been carefully watched over by a vintner, you know, somebody who is like really married to this process and to producing the best wines possible.
And it's so often the case, especially in smaller regions, where the wines have been made by the same families on the same parcels for hundreds of years.
Hats off to tradition.
Yeah.
Mm. Which is preserved so beautifully in France, certainly, and Italy and Europe. And then also, as I was able to note on a recent trip, there are a number of women winemakers who are just doing exceptional work, and they are the next generation inheriting that legacy of generations-owned vineyards.
That's one of the things I really liked about this Mary Taylor. It's a young woman who's really blazing a trail, because there aren't a lot of women négociants that I've come across, and I really like what she's doing, because she is championing these off the beaten track wines that and the vineyard. Excellent. And the family making the wine is on the label as well.
Yes,
and
that is Odile Depont.
Yep, and yep. Odile was the grandmother, and Didier Pellevin is her grandson, and he is the one who is in charge of the estate and the wines now.
In the very beginning of this discussion, we were talking about the Cahors finding its way finally through Bordeaux up to England, where it could be then ultimately shared with the world. So fast forward 800, 1,000 years, and here we are with the négociants, whose role is to do that very job.
It is to do that very job. Luckily, all the constraints of shipping through Bordeaux ended with the French Revolution.
There were
no more kingdoms, no more dukes, Dutch judges, none of that stuff. That was done.
If you were dealing with the Malbec grape, what would be the attributes, Keith, that you would most look for if you were a winemaker in Malbec?
I don't know the grape well enough, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you've got to go out in the vineyard and taste these berries as they're maturing and deciding when to pick. You know, are you going to inoculate with the yeast? Are you going to use the indigenous yeast that's in the vineyard and go a natural process? Every individual would be different in terms of how they would try to put those wines together. And then the blend, you know, are you going to go 100% Malbec? Or are you going to use 20% of, you know, 70% Malbec and 20% Tannat and 10% Merlot? Or depending on the acreage you have and how many barrels you have, you'll be tasting those and then trying to figure out the assemblage to make the best wine you can.
They had said at one point that there was only a 4 or 5 day window for actually picking the grapes, that the window was very narrow. Is that typically the case, or is it, do you know about that relative to the cultivation?
I don't think it's that exact. I mean, here's a winemaker himself who talks about it. I mentioned Didier Pellevin, who runs the vineyard that Mary Taylor represents. He quotes at the end, he said, quote, "I like to go into vineyards on Sunday night when it is quiet to smell the vineyard and think about the level of maturity." That says a lot about how winemakers approach it in
yes.
various places, especially yes. a winemaker who looks after 52 hectares in a region that used to have 48,000 hectares of Cahors under vine.
Back in 1886, that's when the most acreage was in Cahors. That was 80,000 hectares. That is 197,184 acres.
When we were talking about the dedication of the winemakers and what makes a wine taste good, I notice often, without trying to sound trendy, organic wines and biodynamic wines, I enjoy them more and find they have deeper, cleaner flavors. I think there might be only one here tonight that is either organic or biodynamic. I'm not saying the others are not good, but as I explore, when I'm in France, I drink more natural biodynamic wines and organic wines. I'm finding I like them more. There's less off flavors.
Recently, I was traveling in France with family members, and there was one who refused to get any biodynamic wines because he proclaimed that they had a muddy quality to them. I actually agree with you. I think that the tastes happen to be cleaner, less encumbered in some way, and I don't quite know how to describe it, but the flavors are more accessible. The other part of it is that it is simply the right thing to do. You know, it is right to grow anything that we grow in an environmentally appropriate way, right?
There is controversy, however, especially in the natural wines, which takes even biodynamic farming a step further, where you just don't add anything, you don't do anything. You take the grape juice and you ferment it. Tell me if I'm wrong, Keith and Joe.
That's right.
And often,
that is correct.
Often they do have problems, and often they're not very good, or often they can't age. And I get that. There's a little revolution, exciting new thing going on, I noticed in France, where there's tons of young people getting into winemaking, just trying everything. And it's kind of exciting. So you taste natural wines that are like, oh my God, that's an expression of earth, fruit, and heaven. And then you drink another one, you say, oh my God, that's undrinkable. And so there's a lot going on now. in that regard.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good way of experimentation because it's the right path. And it also harkens back to that artisanal quality that we were talking about a few minutes ago.
And more people are going organic and biodynamic in France, I noticed. A lot of them don't mention it. You don't even know it. But that when you buy their wine, that's the way it has been made. You know, we made a point earlier about tasting wines. Sometimes I buy a bottle, and if it's something I'm trying to get familiar with and know whether I want to buy more, I drink it over 3 or 4 days. And that's a real test, too, of what the wine is like and how it was made often. There's exceptions to every thought now, and every experiment.
I agree with that.
Can you describe, though, a little bit in more detail? So over 3 or 4 days, how are you discerning how that wine is made? What information is
often
coming
it's,
forward?
Often it's just getting better and more complex, Cynthia. Mm. Often.
And sometimes it gets thinner and just sort of doesn't hold up.
So thinking about the Burgundy wine, the profile of that wine, and tasting these Malbecs, are there ways that you could characterize some of the differences? Is that a fair question?
Very fair question, yep. You know, there's so many different styles in Burgundy itself. Sometimes I find when you taste Bordeaux, it's very clear that it's a Bordeaux or not. And that might just be me, the way I taste things. And often in Burgundy, there's plenty of room to say, isn't that interesting? That could be maybe be this, you know, a Pinot Noir from the Loire or something from the Jura or white wines especially. The Mâcon region now I'm in love with because there's so many great Chardonnays from there that are so affordable. And they're really delicious. You guys probably agree
excellent.
With me.
Yeah. I totally agree with that.
And I've always loved Beaujolais wines, the Gamay grape. And in Beaujolais, which was known as this mass producer of table wine, it wasn't always good and heavily polluted with pesticides. There's a sort of a revolution going on there now. Tons of young people are there trying to make great artisanal wines that are clean. And so the choices now of things to get out of Beaujolais are so much greater than they used to be.
It's also, there's a kind of a trend. I think a Beaujolais wine was given a very bad rap maybe 10, 15 years ago, and now all of a sudden it's au courant again.
Well, I think the thing about Beaujolais is it is a pretty big area. They produce a lot of wine from the Beaujolais Nouveau to all the way to what they would call the Cru Beaujolais or the Monopole Beaujolais, which are just individual villages usually that sit on higher ground and have made age-worthy Beaujolais wines for years. And they are Fleury, Julianas, Moulin Vent, and Saint-Amour and others. But I think there's 7 of them or something like that. But I would highly recommend that as a very pleasurable Burgundian kind of experience, and the proximity to Beaujolais as a
like,
southern.
Sounds like that's something for another show.
It could be, it could be another.
Definitely.
It could be another
Larry.
Show.
Cynthia,
yes. That's a great segue to the next show, maybe.
Wanted to just do one more tasting through of the 4 wines that we have in front of us, in my view, they each have changed to some degree in the glass. The younger wines, maybe not quite as much as the ones that are a little bit more aged. And while we organize that last tasting, I just want to say again to remind you all that we're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM.
The thing that does amaze me, the color of these wines.
It's beautiful.
I mean, they're all about essentially the same. Sometimes, you know, you get in some areas and the wines will be a different color, but these are this deep garnet red. It's gorgeous. Even the older one, the 2012, which, you know, it's sometimes older wines might turn a little brick color. These are all just beautiful, dark black. As
right,
I say, these
the
are the black
wine.
Wines.
And we've come full circle.
Yeah, right, and they're just a lovely, lovely color.
Yeah, deep garnet. Deep really, garnet. Really beautiful. Very, very beautiful. Yeah. Well, I have to say, I'm really appreciating the Eulalie. I think it's a very, very lovely profile of wine. And I could imagine cooking all manner of wonderful main dishes to go with this particular wine. I think it's lovely and nuanced.
These wines need food, I would say. And yes. They beg to have food.
They're designed to be consumed with food, yeah.
We may want to eat some meals with these wines and come back and comment on them in the future. Who knows?
Oh, that's a great idea, actually. It's great.
With Joe, your point in mind, it really would change the experience.
Well, so in summary, we have just out of the several more bottles that we brought to the table, we only opened four. It was plenty in terms of getting this beautiful profile of wines over a 10 or 12 year stretch. And a very, very interesting inquiry into the Malbec.
Yeah, for me, none of these wines are disappointing. No. I think
they're
really
lovely.
Quite lovely, different. The first one, to me, is very bright, just friendly little
it
wine.
It is. It's very approachable.
Yeah. The one from the Negociant.
Mary Taylor, yeah.
Has sort of it's a little bit of a caramel.
Yes, you know, I know what you mean.
It's a little...
like burnt honey, something.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
Yes.
And it's all stainless steel,
yeah,
right?
It's good,
there's
right.
No, so it's really interesting.
Nice, yeah.
I'm wondering if that one went all the way with the Merlot, the full 30%. I'm wondering.
100%, it's 100% Malbec.
That is
100% Malbec, stainless steel. Yeah. This could be the difference, the soil.
Oh.
Clay over limestone.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's generally speaking the soil types you're going to find in Gaoa because of the uplift in the where the geology of the area works. But I do find, as I taste wines, that any time I find that this clay and decent representation in the terroir, you're going to get a very fruit-forward, bright red fruit expression. And that's what I get in the Mary Taylor
wine.
That
is so interesting.
Yeah.
I love that direct connection to the soil and the geology. It's amazing you can taste that. One can taste that in a bottle of wine.
If we get to do a show on one of my favorite areas, the Willamette Valley of Oregon, because of geologic major movements, there exist both volcanic soils, predominantly volcanic soils, and predominantly clay soils in different very close proximate areas. So these wines can be wildly different that are only 10 miles apart.
I hope we get a chance to do an exploration of the Willamette.
That sounds like Burgundy, Joe.
It is.
Where
it's just
where
like Burgundy.
1 meter away, something changed in the wine.
Right. Or Italy. Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
So what are you thinking, Larry? What are you tasting?
I'm just thinking the oldest. It's still a delight to drink, but you can see how much the fruit flavors have subsided. The fruit has been very, very mellowed, but it's still contributed something that, you know, that's still there.
Well,
and I don't speak as an expert, just someone who drinks wine, by the way.
Well, that's all of us.
That's
we're
all of
not
us.
Experts.
Wait a minute. I just want to say, Joe, you've been a sommelier and a very fine collector, and Keith's been a winemaker.
I was a cellar rat. I was not a winemaker.
I always defer to you guys on. And Joe, you've just mentioned a ton of interesting things tonight.
It's all a beautiful puzzle, I think, wine. And it defines cultures, it defines countries and habits, it defines how people live.
Here we've just explored an entire region of France. Every single bottle was less than $20 a bottle. And it is a grape well worth exploring, the Malbec from Cahors.